is Writers' Voices. You're listening to Cheryl Fusco Johnson, the host on KRUU 100.1 FM. Crew, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. I have a fabulous guest with me today. It's B.K. Lauren. Her writing has garnered many awards and fellowships, including the Mary Roberts Reinhart National Fellowship, a UCross Fellowship, the Dana Award for the novel, a Pushcart nomination, and many others. Her work appears regularly in anthologies and periodicals such as Orion Magazine, the Berkeley Fiction Review, The Future of Nature, and The Best American Spiritual Writing of 2004, which was put out by Houghton Mifflin. Her first book was a fascinating collection of essays detailing her journey studying martial arts. She's a very serious martial artist, and that was commissioned and published by Lyons in 2001. She currently teaches writing at Chatham University's Low Residency Program, the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, where we met, and many other venues throughout the United States. She's been the featured keynote speaker at Associated Writing Program's Pedagogy Forum, and she currently lives with her partner, two dogs and two cats in Colorado. Welcome to the show, BK.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm really thrilled to have you as a guest. I've so enjoyed the writing that you have done, and I have to say that I've found your writing to be unusually lyrical and just fabulous, so I'm glad that you were able to take the time to be with us. One of the things I read is that you said that I think art writing is like any other secret. It begins with listening to a whisper, and I was interested in what kind of whispers you heard when you started writing your latest book, Theft.
Was Willa, and she's the main character. And Willa's voice wasn't necessarily a whisper. She's a little bit of a feisty character, and when I heard her first, she was young. She was only about 12 years old. It took me a long time to hear her adult voice. But when she came to me, I knew that I had a strong character. And when I heard that voice, I knew that that was something that I really wanted to write.
Did you know right away that her brother would be a character as well?
Jeb came a little bit later, but from the first time that I heard Willa, I knew that she had a I knew that she had somebody coming along with her. This sounds so mystical when I'm saying it, but it's really not all that mystical of a process. It really is just writing. So,
I thought it was an interesting choice that you decided to put Willa's voice in first person and her brother's voice in third person, and I felt like that made it really easy to follow exactly what was happening. And I'm wondering, was that something that you've seen done much before? To me, it's a little bit of an unusual choice.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen it done much before. My first editor of my first book, she told me that I wrote like I was raised by wolves, and I always took that as a great compliment. So I don't usually make choices based on things that I've seen before. No doubt those things do influence me. But the reason that it came out in that way, I think, is because I think the entire story is Willa's story. And in the same way that when you are, when we as people are remembering a traumatic event, we, of course, can't have been there when other people who were involved in the event, when they had their portion of the event. So I think this entire story belongs to Willa, and those third-person voices that she's hearing, that's her putting together what happened when she wasn't present. So even though it seems as if it's in Zeb's point of view, it's really Willa trying to get inside of her brother's head and trying to really understand that in the way that we all do when we're trying to piece together something that we didn't understand at the time and we're looking back on.
One of the things I really loved about your book, Theft, was that I felt there was a lot of compassion towards all of your characters. And you portrayed kindness is a quality that I virtue probably above all other qualities. And I felt that you were very kind in your portrayal of the characters. And I'm wondering how many of the people in the book are based on real people that you've encountered in your life.
That's a good question, and thank you so much for saying that about the characters as well. I try very hard to never judge a character, and I don't think that I have any business writing about them unless I truly love them, even if what they're doing and their choices are questionable. So it's really nice that you were able to pick up on that. I appreciate it. are they based on real people? They're a, I mean, I'm a closed system. Writers are closed systems. And so I think everything that I write comes from something in my life, but nothing comes directly from somebody that I actually know in this particular book. There are, the characters are sort of a conglomeration of people that I know, although I will say I have a very interesting brother, and he does wear elk skin, a little bit like Zeb. So I really did draw a lot on growing up with my brother for this as well.
I did find an essay that you wrote about your relationship to your brother, and it might have been like after the death of one of your parents.
That's right, after my mother. And again, my mother did die of Parkinson's, just like the mother in the book.
So,
and you must have read Snapshots of My Redneck Brother.
I think that was it. Yeah, that was really interesting. And I did notice some parallels between your brother and the brother in the book. Did you have any feedback from him about how has he read the essay about him?
Well, he doesn't really get on the cell phone much when he's out in the wild. So I don't really converse with him very often. So I have never gotten any feedback from him on that, no.
Well, he was portrayed as quite a colorful person, so I don't know that he would complain. Sounded like...
Yeah, he's a good guy. He probably would not complain. And that essay will be in my next book that comes out after Seth, which will be out February 12th.
And remind us the name of that book. It's coming out in February. Is that what you said, February 12th?
February 12th. That book is called Animal Mineral Radical.
And that's a collection of essays.
Yes.
Another thing that I was curious about is you write in a lot of different forms, essays and short stories. You've written a collection of your essays about martial arts and now this novel. Do you have a favorite form? What do you like to write in best?
That's a tough question, too. I like to write in whatever I'm hearing at the moment, but I think each process feeds me in different ways. With fiction, you have to create something that isn't there, and that's really challenging, and it's really it really demands a lot of what I call listening, because you're creating something that doesn't exist. And with nonfiction, with creative nonfiction, the challenge is to get it right. Not to get it right, that's the wrong word. The challenge is to, because there is no right, there is no one true story. The challenge is to get it as honest as you can possibly get it, which often has nothing to do with getting it right, and to take that honesty and to shape it into a story, because life doesn't come to us shaped into stories. Life doesn't come to us fully formed as art. So to shape something that already exists into something that is art, that's a different challenge, and I enjoy that too. It's more like putting a puzzle together because the pieces are already there, and with fiction, you have to create the pieces, and then you also have to put them together. It's a little bit different process.
One of the things I noticed across all of the writing of yours that I've read is there's a real lyricism. There's an incredible beauty to the language. And I noticed in the short story that you wrote that was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Could you tell me the title of that again? Was it Cerberus?
I've had a couple nominated for Pushcart, but if it was fiction, it was Cerberus Sleeps.
It was just such a beautiful story, and I loved the language. The language of your prose, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, is just amazing to me. And I saw a lot of references to poetry, and I'm wondering, did you have a childhood where you were exposed to a lot of poetry? Where did that come from?
No, I did not have a child where I was exposed to a lot of poetry, but I naturally was drawn to poetry from the time that I was in second grade. And poetry, I get up every morning and I read poetry. It's my favorite form, but I can't write it. I'm a very bad poet. And so I don't know if I try to put poetry in my prose. It just turns out that way because I love poetry so much. But when I was in second grade, I did have an argument with my second grade teacher about a poem that I had written, and I actually still remember the line of the poem. It was, "But the elves, they play and play." And she told me that I had to write it as, "But the elves play and play," that I had to leave the "they" out. And I told her that the rhythm wasn't correct, and she told me it wasn't grammatically correct. And I left the classroom, and I ran home, and I ran across this big field that we lived in, and I told my mother I was not going back to class until I could write the poem that I, the way that I wanted to write it. So I took my first stand in second grade.
For poetry, that's so amazing.
It had to do with the rhythm of the language. And then I researched it, and I found out that it was grammatically correct, and that if I punctuated it all right, then it was perfectly grammatically correct. And so my mother and I went back into my second grade teacher and told her that, in fact, the elves play and play was not right, and that the elves, they play and play, was okay.
That's so amazing. And I think it's really cool that your mother backed you up.
Yes, I had a great mother, I'll tell you that much. She backed me up in everything. We didn't have a lot of resources, but we had a lot of love.
So where did you find this poetry that you, like, were you going to the library and checking out books of poetry?
You know, I don't actually remember where I found poetry or if I read poetry, but I do remember that I spent all of my allowances on notebooks that I would write, that I would fill every week with what I call poems, and I would bury them. On every Saturday, I would bury them, and then I would go up to the 7-Eleven again and buy a new one when I got my quarter allowance, and I would try to fill the entire book, and then I'd bury it. I always want to go back to that place in my home and see if they're still there. Of course, they'd be. Since it's organic matter, they'd be gone now.
So you physically, when you say you buried it, you don't mean that, like, metaphorically. You physically took these notes.
I took it out into a field and in my backyard and buried it. Yes, I did. I was a very strange child.
That is a little unusual.
But I loved poems. I guess I did have some poems, you know, children's poems. I loved Wink and Blink and a Nod. I loved, I was just drawn to, words have always felt very palpable to me. Like, I can feel them on my tongue, and they feel like they're alive, and they feel like they, you know, they feel like they rub up against each other differently on the page, and I like the way when you put one word next to another word, it dances differently than it does if you put it next to another word, just like two people dance with different partners. Well, words do the same thing, and I just love that about them. If you put the same word next to another word, it moves differently.
Do you also feel...
I sound like a freak talking that's the way it feels to me. They feel very alive.
I can totally relate to that, because when I write something, I always have to read it out loud and notice if the rhythm feels right to me. And when I'm working with student manuscripts, I do the same thing, where I'll think, well, you know, why did they not hear that this rhythm is off in this last sentence? You know, because last sentence is... So, like, I write by ear. Do you also feel a relationship to how the words look, or is it just how do they sound?
There's probably a look in it as well, but mostly it's sound.
Now, is there any connection between your relationship to words and your relationship to nature? Because that seems to be, that was one of the beautiful things about your book, Theft, is the description of nature in it was astounding. So you seem like some conglomeration of this, you know, person that's in your head with these words, but you're also very connected to nature. Do you see a relationship between those two interests?
I know that when I'm in nature, and I fought this for a long time, I have to tell you, I so much wanted to be one of those edgy urban writers, and I tried that, and it doesn't work for me to, you know, when I was younger, I moved to New York, and I thought I was going to write something in New York. I couldn't write in New York because there was not enough nature there for me. And so I had to come back home and write in the place that fed me the most. So I hear more in nature than I do in urban settings.
Does that mean, like, being outside? Like, are you writing on your porch in your backyard, or does that just mean being in that place?
No, I actually have to write in a very like a cave, because I'm creating worlds. But the worlds that I bring with me most readily into my cave That's the natural world. Well, I have to experience it every day. I start my day with 2 or 3 hour hike, and I do that every day. And I'm not able to hear as much, because I do think that writing is listening. So if I don't start my day with 2 or 3 hour walk, and by walk I sometimes mean a very strenuous walk in some pretty rugged territory with my dogs, that's what feeds me. So I go out and I do that, and then I come back into the cave, and all those pieces start sort of forming in my head, and the pieces that speak to me the most come from nature. I could walk all day long in Manhattan, and I could come home and just feel tired. But when I walk out in the woods, I come home and I have stories in my head.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but first I want to remind listeners you're listening to Writer's Voices. Your host today is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. Our guest is B.K. Lauren, who's written in many different forms, is a fabulous writer, and today we're discussing her book, Theft. And our station is KRUU, KRUU, 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. So would you explain a little bit to listeners, B.K., what the setting of your novel, Theft, is?
Yeah, the setting of the novel is southwestern Colorado, and right on the border of southwestern Colorado and northern New Mexico. And those landscapes speak to me, and I really like those landscapes because there's such a contrast between the desert and the lush mountains, right, you know, butted right up close to one another. And the main character is a tracker of the most endangered mammal in North America, the New Mexican wolf, or the Mexican wolf, I should say. I could go on about that a little bit because there's something going on right now, today, with the Mexican wolf, if you wanted me to do that. But if you want to stay in writing, I can certainly do that too.
Well, why don't you tell us about that and also about your experiences, because you yourself worked as a naturalist. Were you also a tracker?
I monitored mountain lions, actually. I've never worked with wolves. And the way the wolf came about in the book is it's kind of interesting to me in my own writing process that the wolf didn't come until the very last draft of the book. And the wolf ended up being on the cover and ended up being a central figure in the book eventually. But it didn't come until the very last draft of the book.
And were you going to tell us some more about what's happening with these Mexican wolves?
Yeah. Today, right as we speak, there's a decision being made. And the Fox Mountain alpha female, who has 4 pups, there's a decision being made to kill her today because of predation. And my main character, Willa Robbins, deals with this in the book. So she's preyed on some cattle in the area, and there's a order on her head to shoot her today. So there's a lot of activity going on right now, and I don't know if I can put out this phone number, but if people are interested in calling and expressing their feelings about this, they can certainly call and leave their feelings about this. I don't want to get too into driving a point, but
I think it's okay to give the phone number. This show will be broadcast on August 17th.
So the telephone number to call is 202-456-1111. And the wolf in question is Fox Mountain Alpha female. She has 4 pups. She's due to be killed today. That they could put a stay on that. Right now there are 58 of these animals in the wild. Only 58 in the United States. Actually, in the wild, period. And there are only 6 breeding pairs. And the last time that they killed a breeding pair, a breeding wolf, was in 2007, in June of 2007. And when that wolf was killed, her pups and her mate were never seen again. So effectively, there were 6 wolves killed.
So the whole family.
Not the one. The entire family.
Yeah. Was lost.
And being that they're the leader of the pack tends to fall apart. The reason that the wolf, coming back to the book, reason that The Wolf was the missing piece for me is that the book is so much about family. I knew nothing about Mexican waltz when I started this. And when I decided to add The Wolf, it added so much to the book. But the reason that the Mexican Wolf was the perfect animal for me was that the book is so much about family, how we form families, what family means, and the wolf is the most bonding creature on earth, I think. That's what I learned in my research.
Did this inspiration to include the wolf come on one of your long walks? Because it sounds like your walks are almost meditations.
Well, they are, yeah. And what came to me on the walk is that I needed an animal in the book and that I wanted it to be an endangered animal, because if I'm writing about Steph, really I'm a writer who writes a lot about a lot of different themes, and the theme of this book is theft. And if I'm writing about theft and extending that metaphor a bit, then I have to write about endangered species and endangered lands and that sort of thing in America. So I knew that I had to, that I wanted to include an endangered animal. So I came home, and the first animal that I researched was a tortoise. I knew it had to be in the Southwest. And the first animal that I came across was a tortoise, and I actually tried to write that for a while, but there's not a lot of dramatic tension in tracking turtles. So I wasn't listening very well when I sometimes your research and your knowledge can get in the way of your writing. And so I tried to force that for a little bit. I tried to force that Willow was dealing with turtles, and that went on for about 2 weeks before I went on another long walk, and I said, I have to get rid of that. And as I was walking, one of my dogs reminds me of a wolf, and I thought, well, maybe I could research a wolf. Well, I came home, and I found out that the Mexican wolf was actually the most endangered mammal in North America, and I knew that I'd hit on something. I knew that I'd been listening right. Then I knew that I'd been listening right when I learned after I wrote the book that the territory, I had to expand the territory because I already had, of the Mexican wolf, I had to expand that territory because I had already set the book in northern New Mexico.
And
what I found is that, and its natural territory is not in northern New Mexico. So fiction, you know, you can do a lot with fiction, so I went ahead and expanded it. But then I learned through talking with a lot of wolf experts that, in fact, they do believe that the wolf did have an expanded territory and it did come into northern New Mexico.
Oh, interesting.
Initially long ago.
Yeah, I did notice you have a note, an author's note at the beginning of the book explaining that you had expanded that territory. I also came across an interesting little quote from you about the importance of place in an essay called What It Is That Feeds Us, and I'm just going to read this. Mountains were my first stories, you wrote. They've been telling my life over and over ever since. And that was from Orion in the July-August issue in 2010. And you went on to say, without place, all stories are weightless. Without place, every sentence is from nowhere. The small field behind the house had become a Hubble galaxy. The turn of the day ticked in my ears like the rhythms of wings flying home. And I just, that's what I mean about your language being so lyrical, that to me it seems like you must spend a lot of time crafting or reading it aloud or listening to the rhythm in your head to get such beautiful lines. But could you talk a little bit more about the mountains and what they mean to you in your writing?
Now, thank you. First, I want to say that piece that you just read from is actually included in the Best American Spiritual Writing of 2012.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's good.
Oh, but it was.
I got a chance to say that. So.
Was it in Orion originally, or am I just?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely, it was originally in Orion, but it did come out later in the Best American Spiritual Writing of 2012.
How did that come about? Did you submit the essay, or did they contact you and ask if they could reprint it? What was the process?
They contact me. For all those best of, they contact you, and you know, they contact the writer and ask them if they can reprint it in the essay. I don't submit it.
Well,
I would never be arrogant enough to do that.
That must have been like a really fun email or phone call to get, to have somebody call you up and say, your writing belongs in the Best Spiritual Writing of the Year.
It's one of the best phone calls that you can receive. It's true. It is true. So what was your, but I just went off onto a little self-promotion there, didn't I?
Oh, no, that's fine.
And your question was about mountains, I think.
Mountains and, you know, like, so you have returned, when you said you had to leave New York to go back to where your muse lived, and it was in Colorado, are you actually living in the place where you were born? Did you really go home?
I really went home. So I actually returned to the city that I was born in and lived on the same field. You know, you asked if the characters are based on real people. That's a real field, and that field played a big role in my life, and that field, I still go back to that field, and there is, in fact, a Taco Bell on that field and a Dairy Queen. Mm. So that is a character to me, and I still walk in that field, and for a long time, I lived on that field until about 2 or 3 years ago. I lived in that same field that I wrote about.
Is that the same field where your notebooks of poetry were buried?
It's the same field, yeah. But those were buried in somebody's yard, and I can't necessarily go into their backyard and dig them up. So the field, when I lived there, the field extended from my backyard, and there was a dirt road, and there were no fences or anything. But now it's very fenced, and that dirt road is a main thoroughfare. That's how old I am.
Well, that must have been hard for you to see those changes.
It was hard then, and it's hard now still. But I see it as sort of a, you know, the layers tell a story, and I can appreciate the layers. I don't necessarily want to go back. I can appreciate the layers of how time works. I'm glad that I know those layers. I'm very glad that I know those layers. So I do get disoriented in places that are flat, though. All my life I've been looking at Long's Peak every morning. It's a 14,000-foot peak that seems to me like an anchor. And if I don't see that, I feel a little disoriented.
Interesting. There's something about the West. You know, you live in Colorado, and if you think of Westerns, those old movies, it was like the landscape itself was a character. And there may be a grandeur there. But I'm sure every region has its own character, and people who live in it love it, just as I love living in Iowa, and it's very flat, you know. I wasn't born here, but this is a place where I'm really comfortable and happy. But there's something about the West that's so grand that it makes an incredible character.
It's like it's just so open. I mean, I lived in Iowa for a while, and I go back there every summer, and I actually love the landscape there. It doesn't vibrate in me the same way that the West does. But I love going there. It feels very relaxing. It just doesn't get to the marrow of my bones like the West does. And then likewise, when I go down to New Mexico, it's a different landscape than Colorado, and it feels so different, and it feels very, at the risk of sounding trite, New Mexico feels very spiritual to me. And what I always say is that I don't want to live there because I don't want to live in my temple. It feels like a place to clear, to go for clearing and stuff. It feels very spiritual. Whereas the West, Colorado, I feel pretty ensconced, and I feel like there's an openness, and there's also a horizon with some shape on it, and it just feels like the place that defines me the most.
Interesting. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson, your host today. Our guest today is B.K. Lauren. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called Theft. It's a fabulous novel, really beautiful prose, and very compassionately tells the story of a brother and sister and other people that entered in and out of their lives. A question that came up for me as we were talking, BK, was you mentioned living in Iowa, and I understand you went through the Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa.
I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I got sick before I finished. So I indeed was a student in the MFA program there, but I got sick before I finished that program.
So the time that you were able to spend there before you fell ill, did you feel like it contributed to, obviously you'd been filling up these notebooks since you were in second grade, so you were a writer for decades probably before you entered the program, but do you feel it shaped or changed the way that you write?
Everything shapes and changes the way that I write. I loved my time in Iowa, and I loved my colleagues there. There's so many smart readers. And it was the input that I got from other writers was absolutely invaluable. And just sharing that time with other writers who are seriously working toward something meaningful, that was, it was a very valuable time for me.
Did you feel that?
Likewise, I would say that the illness that followed was a very valuable time for me and shaped my writing as well.
So I have many questions about that. The first one is, getting back to the program, did you feel that you started taking yourself more seriously as a writer because you were surrounded by other writers who were taking themselves seriously?
I was so innocent as a writer. Like, I didn't come from, you know, I wasn't expected to go to college, and it took me a long time to figure out that, yes, I could go to college. And so I was such an innocent writer that I, from the day I was born, in a ridiculous way, I took myself very seriously as a writer. When I was in seventh grade or eighth grade, I put a sign on my door that nobody should disturb me because I was writing a novel. And in fact, I did. I wrote this novel. I had never read a novel in my life, but I started writing this long story that ended up being, like, I don't know, 800 pages or so. I've been very obnoxious about that all my life. I take myself seriously as a writer. I always have. But when I was there, what I learned was that, oh, there's a community of people kind of like me, and I never knew that before. It was really nice to be around other people who were taking themselves seriously as writers and to feel that energy. It's like the difference between when you meditate alone in your room and then you meditate in a hall with a group of people. There's a different energy, and a lot of magic can happen then. And I my colleagues there, I just, they're invaluable to me.
So, pursuing that idea of being in a community of writers, you do a lot of teaching. What do you feel of writing? That's right, isn't it, that you teach writing?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. So what do you feel produces the best climate for people who are trying to learn how to write? As a teacher, how do you try to foster encouraging them to write?
Well, the first thing that I do is I try to get publishing out of their heads. I think that with writing, it's not the only art, but it seems like we jump to the end very, very quickly in writing. For instance, if you tell somebody that you're taking guitar lessons, their response usually isn't, oh, are you going to cut a CD soon? And if you tell somebody that you're taking dance lessons, they don't ask you if you're going to dance on Broadway. But if you tell somebody that you're taking your writing class this weekend, they say, oh, have you ever published anything? So we jump to the end and we kill the process. And the first thing that I try to do when I teach is to get people to not think about the end, because if you can't get to a place where the process is important, then you'll never get to an end that matters. You'll only get to an end that is forced. I wish that we had several different words for writing also. I think that there are so many reasons to write that are very, very valid that have nothing to do with publication. And I think that publishing is a different thing, and I think so many writers come to it with that in mind. So the first thing that I try to do is to sort of let go of that, and then we can begin the process of learning to write.
So
after that, it really is just a letting go. And beginning to listen to their own voices.
Do you feel that some of that developing a patience for the process and appreciation of the process rather than product is rooted in your exploration of martial arts?
Probably. It's rooted in probably, I would say, because it's certainly in martial arts or in any moving meditation or any kind of meditation, which I spend a lot of my youth doing, if you look toward the end, you get hit in the face. You know, there's immediate feedback for looking beyond where you are in the moment in martial arts. And I think that's the thing that I liked about martial arts the most, is it, if you are not in the moment, you get immediate feedback that you're not in the moment. And so when you're sparring, for instance, which used to be my favorite thing, when you're sparring, if you're not completely present, you get immediate feedback that you're not completely present. And that presence, that's what I love about writing. That's what I love about writing is that moment. It's not the moment when, I mean, it's a great call to get when somebody says, we want to publish your book, or we want to, as you said, you know, put one of your pieces in the best of the year. Those are fantastic calls to get. What's even better for me is that process that happens every single day in that place that I get to go every single day. That feels the best to me.
Hmm. Well, you're certainly in the profession you should be in then, it seems like. We've been talking about your latest book. Before I ask you to do a reading from it, would you also tell me the name of your book of essays about martial writing? That was your first book.
That was my first book, and I'm a little bit disappointed in the title of that book. It's called The Way of the River, and there it is. That's the name of the book.
And I'm
not happy with the name, but...
But the essays inside it are great. They're very interesting about how you developed as a writer, and also some of the language in there is very lyrical, even though that was like your first book and you know have been developing your style since then. Very beautifully written book about martial arts.
Thank you.
And would you explain how that book came to be?
Well, that book came to be because somebody called me and asked me to write it. I never, ever thought of writing about martial arts. When I did martial arts, I was told that you don't speak about martial arts, and... I actually turned the publisher down 4 times, but I was working with an agent at the time, and she encouraged me to take the 4th offer. So I didn't have a notion to write a book about that. I wrote one essay about it, and they read one essay about it, and they called me and asked me to write the book, which was very kind, and I was very excited, and I'm very grateful for that. But it felt awkward for me to be writing about martial arts. And so what I tried to do is to make a book that was ostensibly about martial arts, but really wasn't, was about something more internal than that, and about something broader than that. And I hope that I achieved that toward the end. That book moves like martial arts moves. It moves from the external to the internal. And when you're doing martial arts, you start with external forms. At least the martial arts that I do, you start with external forms and you move to internal forms. So you can watch the tone of that book change as you move from beginning to end. And that was a really fun thing for me to do once I decided to go ahead and do it. I thought, oh, I can do this, but I can do it in a different way. And I hope I achieve that in a different way. It's not a martial arts book. In fact, people who have read it and reviewed it say, you know, this book really isn't about martial arts, although it is. It uses martial arts as a window to something else, I hope.
Well, you always find your own take on things, it sounds like. And I'm wondering if you would share an excerpt from the book Theft.
You bet. Yeah, I'd love to read from Theft. If I could, I'd like to read something from Willa when Willa is 12 years old. In the book, Willa is the main character, and Willa is 12 years old, and then there are other sections where she's a young adult. And in this section, she's 12 years old, and what the readers or what listeners need to know is that her mother has Parkinson's, and her brother's name is Zeb, and Zeb and Willa have a little bit of a stealing thing going on. That's one way that they deal with their mother's Parkinson's. And the other way that they distract themselves from their mother's Parkinson's is through fishing. And so this is a fishing scene. Zeb watches from across the pond. He sees me struggling. When he sees me struggling, he understands the size of my catch. He digs the handle of his pole into the ground, sets it with a rock, and comes running to my side of the pond. He has his arms around my shoulders in seconds, helping me turn my reel and pull. "Steady, steady," he says, but he's no steadier than I am, and that fish is fighting like a bucking bronco. "Son of a bitch!" He's a beaut, Zeb. He's a son of a bitch. We pull. The fish is suspended above the pond now, thrashing on the end of the line, no letting up. Jesus, Zeb, he's a monster. Just pull him in, Willa. Pull him in. I'm trying. And right about then, I give the pole over to Zeb, duck underneath his arms, and wade quickly out into the pond. With the water nearly up to my chest, I reach up and grab the flopping fish with my hands. Good job, Willa. Yeah, steady him, steady him. We work together to get this monster to shore. I try my best to tame the thing, and the reel ticks faster, and then snap, the line breaks, and my huge fish slithers down in front of my overalls, hits the pond, and slips back into the smooth surface. Zeb walks toward me, lifting his knees high and splashing into the pond. Then he stops. He shades his brow with one hand, looks out across the bright water. I'll be damned. That fish is gone. We let it get loose, Zeb. Smooth surface of the pond sparkles. No sign that fish ever existed. I guess it's getting time to go to church anyway, I tell him. But my escaped fish has Zeb's full attention now. Hey, I'm going, I tell him. But he keeps looking across the pond. I walk back home alone, thinking about how close I came to that beautiful catch. Skipping now to when they get to the church. When we get there, the bells chime and the people walk in their Sunday best, the headachy smell of women's perfume everywhere. The church has ceilings as high as the houses on the other side of the field. I take my seat and choose my hymn book. I sing when Mom and Dad sing, stand when they stand, and sit when they sit. I want to go up to the altar when the pastor says, take, eat, this is the body of Christ he gave for you. But I stay in my seat, and I watch Dad wheel Mom up to the front where everyone kneels except my mom, and she has a hard time getting that little cup of wine to her lips without spilling it. I have to turn away from watching, so I study the stained glass window that shows Jesus opening his robed arms to the little lambs surrounding him. The colors look like lifesaver candies to me, the sun streaming through in rays of cherry, lemon, grape, and lime. I think of it, Jesus, the lifesaver. When everyone comes back from drinking the wine with the cracker, we all press the palms of our hands together in prayer, and I notice that all these praying hands are shaped just like fish jumping out of a pond. I imagine this is what Jesus sees when he looks down from heaven, the church like a well-stocked pond, and I finally understand what Miss Spraddle meant when she said, Jesus is a fisher of men. He has his hooks out for us, and he'll snag our hands when we're praying and pull us straight up to heaven. Right then, I look over at Mom, and I press her praying hands down into her lap. She gives me the eye, then raises her hands back up into prayer. And I slap them down this time, wrestling with her to keep her fish hands in her lap so Jesus will not snag them. Dad opens his praying eyes now and sees my bad behavior. He shakes his head and gives me the stern look. But I keep wrestling with Mom until Dad takes both of my hands and pins them to my lap. It feels horrible. Like my whole body is trapped, and I want to scream, but I'm helpless, and so I turn my prayer away from whatever the pastor's saying. I squeeze my eyes, and I pray harder than I've ever prayed. I pray when the time comes for Jesus to reel Mom in, she will be like the fish that I hooked this morning. She'll struggle out of his grip and slip down the front of Jesus' robe and right back into the pond of the living. I realize this is why her limbs flop around sometimes, because he has her suspended on his line above the water, and she's writhing to get free. I pray my mom's line will snap soon.
Oh, that was a beautiful and poignant passage from your book, Theft. And I'm wondering, how was it to write about a mother with Parkinson's when your own mother had Parkinson's?
Thank you for letting me read that section, and thank you for that comment about Parkinson's, too. It was good to write about Parkinson's. To me, it's a disease that doesn't get a lot of attention, and people don't understand it much, and it's a heartbreaking disease. And it was really good to get it down on paper and to look at it from that distance.
Well, there's also... And it was beautifully written, and, you know, it's hard to even continue talking after hearing you read it. because everybody has their losses, whether it's Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or, you know, some other terrible disease. We all lose people.
Yeah.
But I sort of forgot what I was going to say there, but you had your own experience of having an illness, and were you able to write at all while that was happening to you?
No, I didn't. I didn't write for, after I left the Iowa Writers' Workshop, I didn't write for 12 years. I was struggling with an illness that was working its way through my body. It was one of those hard things to diagnose. It was an autoimmune disease, and I still struggle with it now and then, but I'm here, and it's fine, and it was not as bad of an illness as many other people experience, and so I just feel grateful that I'm here.
Yeah.
I did, during that time, I had intermittent loss of language, and when you lose language, you come back to it with different eyes, especially when you love it as much as I love it. And so coming back to it again was like coming back to a lover after you've gone away and had an affair or something. You're a little more careful, and you love a little more gently.
Well, you already had such an impassioned relationship to language. I can't imagine, you know, what that would have felt like to lose it for a while and then come back. It would be like being blind and being able to see again. That must have been an incredible...
Yeah, it was an amazing time and a very frustrating time. And I never take language for granted, I'll tell you that much.
Well, I'm glad you're able to take your 2 and 3 hour walks and continue to write. And tell me a little about what you're working on now.
Oh, probably 2 days ago, I've been struggling with starting a new novel, and 2 or 3 days ago it came together, and it's looking pretty good now. So I'm very happy about that. And that happened on a walk, and it seems to be going strong now. I don't want to talk too much about what it's about, because I don't want to release it before it has its own life. So I'm working on a novel, and then I'm also working on a creative nonfiction book that has a little bit more information in it than I usually work with.
Do you feel like sharing the topic of the nonfiction book?
Right now it's called Rewilding the Mind. And it's kind of about where we are in, it's a really difficult topic to say. I always say if I could say things in one sentence, I wouldn't spend so much time writing 80,000 words, you know? And I'm really bad at that elevator pitch thing. I'm really bad at that. But I believe that the way that we relate to nature and our destruction of nature has a lot to do with the way that we relate to language, and the way that language is, to a degree, being overlooked and destroyed at very quick writing. They have nothing.
So by
the fact that the number one bestseller right now was written on an iPhone in a subway does bother me a little bit, and it doesn't speak to me of the time and patience and care that you should show these wonderful things, words. And that same sort of thing, that same sort of destruction that's going on with language, with what we read, what we write, I think there's a direct correlation between that and nature and rehabilitating nature. That's what the book is about.
Wow.
It's called Rewilding the Mind.
That's really interesting. I'm looking forward to reading that when you get that out and published. And share a little bit about what is coming out in February. What sorts of essays are you going to have in that book? And what's the title?
The subtitle of Animal Mineral Radical is a flock of essays on wildlife, food, and family. And most of the essays in the book have been published before. In fact, I think all of them have been published before in different places, but I've put them together now into a book that makes sense. And what are they about? They're about food, family, and wildlife. Probably the thing to drive me the most.
Well, they all sound good. Speaking about driving you, do you do much traveling to promote your work?
Yeah, well, I am now. I just got back from reading from what I call the Southwest Tour, and I read in Durango, had a great time there, and I paired up with the great old Broads for Wilderness, and we had a great show together. And then I read in Taos and Salida, so that Southwest swing was good. I read in Iowa. I'm going to be reading in Pittsburgh next, in Chicago.
And cool.
After that, back to Boulder at Boulder Books, and also Old Firehouse Books up in Fort Collins. And then this particular tour is over. And something I'm pretty excited about, I'm going to be traveling with Harry Green, who's a science writer. I'm going to be traveling with him next year, and we're going to be talking about the crossovers between art and science.
Oh, that sounds really fascinating. How did that how did that come to be?
Well, Harry contacted me. He read Redneck Brother, and he contacted me. He is in the biology department at Cornell University. He's a herpetologist, and he contacted me because he liked my writing. Well, then I read his writing, and he's a spectacular writer. He's a science writer, but he's won many literary awards for his work, and we just became fans of each other's work, and we said, let's take the show on the road and talk about the things that, you know, he can bring the science to it, he can bring the information, I bring the art, and then we talk about the crossovers of that, and I'm very excited about doing that with Harry. His new book, in fact, he's the epigraph of my book is by Harry, and Tracks and Shadows, Field Biology as Art is his memoir that's coming out in the spring, and so we'll both be traveling around and talking about those books together.
Well, he sounds like a person we might want to invite on Writer's Voices, too. It sounds like a very interesting guy.
Can I read his epigraph from Tracks and Shadows?
Certainly.
He says, although we'd like to believe animals relocate when their habitats are destroyed, most organisms have nowhere to go. They will die rather than move. Worse yet, these losses are usually unseen and writ large all over the world. We are truly thieves pillaging the future.
And so
that's Harry Green, my buddy.
And that was right inside your, like, that was the one of the opening pages of your book, Theft.
That's right, yeah. Our work has resonated well together.
Well, very cool. So you'll have to probably work through the winter planning what you're going to do.
Yeah, Harry writes. Harry has over 200 publications, and so he's. I have to catch up to him.
Well, it's a great partnership. It sounds like.
I'm looking forward to it.
So, what do you feel are some of the books that shaped you? You've talked a little bit about poetry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Poetry definitely shapes me. I love. Let's see. I love W.S. Merwin's work. I love Hayden Carruth has been a big influence. In fiction, I would say Virginia Woolf is my biggest influence. She was. I read To the Lighthouse, and I knew that I had to write a novel at that point. I also like the Russian writers. Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Whenever I'm asked, of course, I draw a blank.
Well, I liked. I don't remember where I got this quote, but I got another quote from you that I found online, and it said, "Through writing and reading, the circle of embracing all kinds of difference grows in ways it could not if I relied solely on my direct experience of life." And I thought that was a nice little summation of why it is important to read.
That sounds really good. I'm glad that I said that. I don't know where it came from, but I like it.
Well, I'll have to look back at my notes, and then I'll be able to tell you where that came from. There was a...
That happens so much to me, Cheryl. I don't, you know... when I hear things back, I always think, oh, that sounds pretty good, but it doesn't feel that way when I write it.
There was a little, you made several references to poetry in your short story, Cerberus Sleeps, And there was one that I couldn't place, and I wondered if you wrote this. It was, here's the line, eternity exists for us like a tongue for a deaf mute.
The fantastic writer Odysseus Elitis, who won the Nobel Prize, and very few Americans know him. Fantastic, fantastic poet from Greece. I'm probably pronouncing his last name incorrectly. It's E-L-Y-T-I-S.
Interesting. Because I found the other, like I would just Google lines of poetry that I found that you had included in that short story, and I put this one in and nothing came up.
Yeah, Cerberus is a very poetic dog. Cerberus actually will be in my next novel. Like, that much I can say.
Oh.
About my next novel.
That's very cool.
He's immortal, so he has a lot to say.
So what did you study in, did you study poetry at all when you were in your undergraduate?
No, I studied ancient Greek, actually. I had a double major in ancient Greek and modern philosophy. Both equally useless degrees.
But you've had a lot of interesting jobs.
I have. I finished my degree early. I finished both of those degrees in 3 years, and so then I studied architecture. That one I could have made some money with, but that was only a one-year program. But I have had a lot of, I have sort of done a lot of things to support my writing habit, definitely.
I read that you were a professional brainstormer. What is that? Who would you do that for?
I still do that on occasion. I'm hired by companies who are branding or trying to change a brand or trying to change their look in some way, and they need to figure out how to make that more interesting, more creative, more appealing, brighter, more vibrant, something like that. So I get together in a room with a bunch of other people, and it's really like play all day long.
Well, I can understand how you can do that because, you know, clearly you were developing your mind from a young age and you operate a little skewed from many people. But how would they recognize that you could do that? Did you have some kind of, like, PR credential?
No, I was, the first person that hired me, I was standing in line at a coffee shop and I started talking to her, and she liked the way I went off on tangents and said, could you please come and do this for me? So she hired me, and then there's an inner circle, of course, so then other people, when they hear that you're a good brainstormer, then other companies hire you, and it just goes on from there. And it's nice work. It's fun work. You get to do very fun things. And I got to learn a lot of things that I normally wouldn't know about. Like, for instance, I don't think I can say who I worked with, but I can say that I got to go, got a backstage pass to the largest feedlot in America, and I was able to cover all, you know, the entire feedlot and look at all 90,000 head of cattle for this one job, because they also give you the background on the product that you're working on.
Well, yeah, that makes sense, because how could you brainstorm about it if you didn't have some background?
Yeah, so a lot of it will be research, but it's not research where you read a book or something. They'll actually take you to places that you normally would not have access to at all, and that feeds my writing, too. That's really a wonderful thing. So I've had a lot of fun doing that.
Well, I've had a lot of fun talking to you today, and unfortunately our time together is coming to a close. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. I had a great time. You're so generous. Thank you.
And I want to remind listeners that you've been listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU, 100.1 FM. My name is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. Our guest today has been B.K. Lauren, and we've been talking about her great new novel called Theft.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.